Did you feel listen to the last edit?
No, I did not.
Does Zina show any interest in this or even know about
She knows about it, has not shown any interest.
it? How about your wife, Keith? Has she listened to the audios?
No.
Is that because she's not interested, or you just haven't told her about it, or both?
Well, I've told her about it. She knows that I'm doing it. I don't know if she might not know that it's actually available, although I think she does. But yeah, this is probably,
Not the kind of stuff she wants to be hearing.
yeah, it's maybe two steps beyond, you know, what she's willing to entertain.
Well, I think there's, as I say, tradition that might be too much of a word but to use, but whatever, that wives tend to not be interested in what their husbands are doing, and they're kind of, it's a kind of grounding influence they have, all that crazy stuff. They kind of tolerate, indulge their husbands. But, that sort of cliche.
Well, I think it's certainly accurate in this case.
Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
My guess is, and I don't want to paint Strieber with, I don't want to diagnose him at any point, even though it might seem that this whole piece is kind of skirting around the diagnosis. But anyway, my sense is that most similar cases to Strieber's would be seriously dysfunctional people. People who had been so traumatized that they were multiple personalities, psychotic, schizophrenics, just not able to function really at all. That's my guess. I spoke to Doug yesterday, and first thing he said, pretty much about chapter five, Secret Guardian, was that I had presented a very strong case for Strieber being psychotic, and I wanted to deny it, right? Oh, I was thinking, oh, God, Whitley's listening to this. That's it. He's not gonna listen to anything else after that, because that's such a yeah.
That's kind of a deal breaker.
Yeah, totally. So, well, maybe I'll put it to you too, because you've just read it. So, I mean, how do you interpret that comment, and how do you see that, the picture that it paints of Strieber?
Well, I am not completely sure exactly yet, but I will say that I had, up until I started reading this, completely dismissed him and thought I had him completely figured out. And, but after reading this, it's like, okay, there's something is there worth considering. So let me go back and see what this guy is saying, claiming, writing, putting forth.
So, how had you boxed him? What box had you put him in previously?
Oh, pretty much that whole, writing career, maybe having trouble with ideas, read Missing Time in 81, had a great idea a while after that, maybe a dream, gave him a dream, and then he woke up and thought, that's what I'll do. I'll say I'm one of these people, and I'll look into all this, and I'll gather all this information, and then a complete snow job, basically, putting in all these little hints, like, oh, I completely dismissed UFOs. And another point, he says, he saw something walk into the room, or some sort of, a blurred vision or something or whatever. And he said this was not a hypnopompic experience. It's like knowing in advance through his research and being an intelligent guy who just knew such things, that that would be another claim that other people would make. It's like, okay, you were in a half dream state if it wasn't a full dream. You're either lying, or it's a full dream, or it's a half dream, or something. And so on and so forth. So, yeah. So I kind of just dismissed him like that. And I'd only read the first book. So, yeah.
Would someone who's incapable of distinguishing between reality and a dream be considered psychotic?
I think that's very much the definition of psychotic, as nothing else, distinguishing between what's real and unreal.
Because, you know, in, I'm not sure what page this is, but where he's talking about the memory of being on a train surrounded by soldiers, lying unconscious in beds.
That's when he was 12, yeah.
Right, and he tells his father that it's all right. That is a dream.
Why do you say
that? I just...
Yeah, that was my... I had a very strong impression of the same thing.
That is a dream. I'm sorry. I don't know how else to put it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that is a memory that actually occurred in sort of real time or
okay.
real space, whatever.
Well, but does it have to be either one or the other? It's the same. I mean, is there such thing as something that is absolutely one and not the other?
Well, that's where we get into that whole liminal
exactly
thing. Yeah.
So yeah, psychosis is it may be an inevitable stage of letting go of, you know, our interpretations of what reality is and our ego structures. I know this is kind of an old chestnut, and I don't necessarily get pulled into that whole discussion of the shaman or the schizo thing, but just in this context, I mean, specifically the dream, my sense was always that it's real, but then I've always kind of taken really at face value for whatever reasons. But, it, I mean, in the new context of this exploration, what seems to be absolutely irrefutably real about that experience was that he saw his father in a state of terror at some critical stage in his life. And that,
right.
that had what? This absolute, you know, catastrophic impact on his psyche.
Yeah.
Because it was, again, to me, Doug, about this, and he, right away, he initially, the way he defined psychosis in Lacanian terms was to do with when a child is not able to identify with his father and therefore doesn't have that kind of, doesn't develop that inner sense of an I, of an ego, an identity by identifying with and emulating a male figure. So that's the individuation thing being fished out of the mother's psyche. And if Strieber, particularly maybe earlier as well, but particularly that coming of age period of 12, if he saw his father in a state of absolute terror and impotence, the last thing in the world he would have been able to do or wanted to do would be identify with that. And maybe this whole project is an attempt to redress what I see as an imbalance, but the Strieber's choice of focusing so exclusively on the visitor phenomena and rendering everything else to sort of footnote and backstory, that in itself seems evidence of something.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you take the visitors out of the context, like he'll allow, okay, I was brutalized as a child and that opened up my psychic floodgates, and then I access the visit, and then, but that's all in the past now, and now we have the greys, and they're these wonderful hard taskmasters who'll beat the shit out of us, but we will evolve. It's like the whole thing is becomes this massive rationalization for his own experience. Is it more than a rationalization? I mean, that's not the right word. It's he's reframing, he's recontextualizing, and he's turning it into this fiction that allows him to live with it and feel as though this is all a positive evolutionary engagement that he's involved with, rather than wrestling with this trauma that he simply cannot actually accept and integrate.
Yeah, the last quote that you use in the beginning of the piece, where he says, "I do not find the small gray beings terrible. I find them useful."
Yeah.
That could have many different meanings. The useful bit.
Yeah. For example.
I think what he means is that, as you said, they're agents in leading our evolution, but of course another interpretation is that they're useful to him
mm-hmm.
in his narrative. And there could be other meanings of that term, I'm sure, but
well,
those two jump out.
Yeah, the one that jumped out to me, I'm interested to hear what meaning it has for Phil as well, was the kind of occult subtext of a, you know, a sorcerer using allies.
That too.
Yeah, I mean, there's a, going back to the whole topic of play acting and belief and fantasy life and so on and so forth. I mean, you can do a lot by pretending something is real or believing it temporarily as if it were real. And completely, not in a sort of a half-hearted, not really holding on to it, but absolute total belief. If you're adept at such things and being able to let go of that belief later or just go in and out of it at will, which is a shamanic power, of course, or, you know, essential, you know, anything really, if you want to do any sort of imaginative work, which he does, obviously, you can't deny that he's an imaginative worker. You know, he's does creative things. He's a creative type.
Mm-hmm.
So, and because of his prior documented occult leanings, Process Church, I believe, accurately or not, Wikipedia mentions that he was into Gurdjieff or
whatever else.
You know?
Yeah, that was
so he's already doing all this stuff. He's well versed in all this. He knows what hypnopompic is. He's read all the, he's read Kiel. He's read all the different UFO researchers, you know, on every side of the. So he has an overview of all the different viewpoints and lenses that one could apply to this. And if he is that type of person who has that play-acting creative ability, shamanic, you could say, you compare it to at least. I mean that's kind of what we, it's what we do. We look at that as like that's a valid metaphor at least to use for that sort of power or that practice. Yeah, I mean, useful could mean a lot of different things. And to me, and it kind of skirts both those things. Useful to him personally, yeah. Useful evolutionarily, maybe he, if he could entirely believe that he is somehow affecting his own quote unquote evolution by utilizing these visitors in a sort of make believe, sort of, but actual complete total belief fashion to, you know, to cause these experiences. And if he actually started doing this as a result, then he may very well start having strange experiences and dreams, because that's what happens when you really get into that.
Yeah.
You know, whether you're meaning to or not, once you start that, once you open that door, weird things start to happen. And, you know, if he's an adept enough worker, he can go, you know, work with these, this material. He can go in and out of it at will and somehow not dominate it, but he can remain in control enough to write books about it, pontificate about it, theorize about it, and so on and so forth. And somehow in his heart somewhere, not completely believing it and it not being completely real, but anyone who completely, you know, doesn't understand the whole liminal idea would dismiss anything that's either not 100% true or 100% lie, you know? So
two other things come to mind here. One, there is this desire to, no matter what terrible things happen, if you can learn from the experience and you can grow from it, then that justifies the tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this desire to, whatever happens, to try to make it useful somehow. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing. The other thing that occurs to me is that the incredible irony of saying that he finds them useful. I think the reverse is probably more accurate, if at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's useful to them. I mean, why he would say that, it just seems more likely that he's being used rather than he's using them. So it's almost a reversal, or that he wants to believe that that's true.
Yeah. I mean, that's a common thing in a lot of relationships too, where it's like, yeah, I'm completely in control of this relationship. It's like, no, you're the bottom dog. You're not the top dog. Everybody always has a, you know, a different idea of their position in a relationship than possibly might be justified based on the reality of it. And, you know, we are like that, you know, so I'm going to go vote for president because I'm a free American and this is my government and my vote is absolute total freedom. It's the greatest freedom in the world. I mean, I'm going to vote for president. And if I vote for president, then I'm still, it's like, no, you're not, you know, you're no less enslaved because you can vote for president than, you know, if you had a dictator for president. Same thing there with that. Oh, I find them useful. It's like, well, yeah, maybe in a way, but maybe in a larger point of view, if you accept any of this on whatever basis, then of course they find him useful is how to really, but it can be both. It can be both.
Yeah, I think it is invariably both. Like it's a symbiotic relationship that he's describing, and it's true of, you know, Castaneda's accounts of the sorcerer and the allies, is that the inorganic beings will help you out. They will assist you. They'll give you powers and all kinds of visions, but they're definitely getting something in return. And at the end of the day, the end of the sorcerer's life, probably more accurately, then the discovery is made that, in fact, the allies have kind of been snaring, or sort of created a snare by offering these little crumbs, these little perks, in order to lead the sorcerer into some sort of trap.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't necessarily want to talk about Castaneda's accounts any more literally, as any more literal than Strieber's, but this may kind of represent a psychological process in terms of the psyche that's fragmented, that gives rise to these autonomous complexes that, on the one hand, control one, but on the other hand, can be controlled by one. Like the Guardian, for example. I mean, the Guardian is a way to be safe and to be powerful in a social sense. If you allow the Guardian to take you over, it will empower you at an ego level. But of course, you are marching to its drum, and it is a fragment. It's not coming from your total, you know, innermost authentic self. So inevitably, in the end, yeah, you are being used by, or misused even.
Now, is the is the Guardian a figure that arises to protect the traumatized child, to foster the development of a somewhat functional ego, to protect them from these forces of dissolution, sort of thing?
More or less, yeah.
That sort of thing. So that's sort of the idea.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you think of it not as a literal guardian, that word is overused, but specifically, like, the meaning of a guardian is someone who guards a space. And so you could imagine that there's a compartment that is created in the psyche through trauma where it's safe, like that dissociated space, that dissociative space where the pain of the body or the stress of the body can't enter. And so the awareness, the local awareness, or whatever you call that, conscious awareness of the child retreats into that space, and that it's safe there. Everything outside of that space is unsafe. You could even see it in terms of the body, like what's happening to the body is overwhelming, so the awareness retreats to the head, let's say, or to part of the body that's safe. Maybe it could even be the thumb or the little finger or the genitals, maybe is often the case, because that's where we seek gratification, is in the genitals. I don't know, but the guardian would be like this psychic agency that actually guards that space and makes sure that the awareness doesn't come out of it, and that nothing outside of that space enters into it. So then when our awareness starts to get closer to the areas of experience, the memories or the trauma in the body or aspects of ourselves, whatever it is that are threatening, then the guardian comes out, like, pops up, like one of those things in the carnival pops out, and whatever colors that it chooses to wear that are most appropriate. It can be protective and benevolent and loving, if that's going to work, and if that's not going to work, then it will be severe and punishing. So I think most of us experience the guardian as this self-talk, like this is constant self-judgment, you're no good, you're shit, get out of bed, you're fucking worthless, all of that stuff. And but also, though, you're so great, you really did that beautifully this time, and yeah, keep...
That's you reading my thoughts, Aaron. Constant piece of shit, you're so fucking great. Yeah. Well, it kind of goes back for me in my mind. My comparison would, again, be the relationship thing where, you know, it works. It'll work for a while, however many years, 4 years, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, 10 years, 12, whatever. You're both kind of using each other, and it's like to each other's mutual benefit. But at a certain point, one of the people in the relationship realizes that they're no longer getting what they need out of it. They're no longer using the person, that's no longer useful. And to stay in the relationship from then onward, of course, would be self-destructive. You know, so we see that all the time. People who get out of a relationship at the right time and before the person completely drains them dry, and they destroy each other, because that's sort of symbiotic, self-destructive, mutually destructive, codependent sort of relationship. Or, they don't get out and they are destroyed and so on. But, you know, to me, Strieber seems to be, have struck a balance of some kind, one way or the other, to where he's not destroyed yet, and he's still getting something out of it. Mm-hmm. It seems to me, anyways. I mean, something. So say, oh yeah, the Castaneda. I know you don't want to make too much out of that comparison, but one thing I thought after kind of glancing through Communion a couple times was, what was that first Castaneda book?
The Teachings of Don Juan.
Right, that one. So he writes this book, whether Don Juan was a fabrication or a composite of two or three different personalities or an actual person embellished, whatever, not even sure what all the issues are behind all that, writes the book. I mean, and it was a hit, as I recall, bestseller, just like Communion was. Book comes out. So you put this thing out there. You have this idea. You manage to write this book, which is a combination of fact and fiction and true and false, but not completely false, but somehow at least metaphorically true, or true at heart. And it's a hit, and that sort of opens the floodgate, like, okay, it's a hit, and then suddenly you're in that whole world. And then he writes another book and another book and another book, and and eventually he's a cult leader in a sense, and somehow self-destructive, and same with and destructive of other people in a way. Same with Strieber. I mean, this Communion could have been a flop. Mm-hmm. If it was a flop, would he still be writing books about it, or would he said, okay, that attempt failed? Would he just written another vampire novel or gone in back to I don't know? Would he be selling insurance today? Was it purely people, like I think we discussed also before, the whole hoaxer and believer of the crop circles, where I was basically saying it's like, well, the person hoaxing these crop circles, in my understanding of it, is not a complete disbeliever just pulling the wool over other people's eyes and tricking them. They're obviously, they crave this mystery too, sort of thing. So once you get that eager to listen to more audience, suddenly you develop that relationship where now you're going to do more and more and more. Maybe that first crop circle or a second crop circle, nobody gives a shit. It's like, who fucked up my crop? My what happened to the corn? You and then, track the guy down, beat the shit out of him, and that's the end of it. No more crop circles. But, you do a crop circle, people are amazed, and, their eyes are wide, and you see the mystery and all the news stories and everything. It's like, suddenly, it's addictive.
The positive feedback loop.
Right. So, I see a lot of that here, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I would mention, though, just unlike Castaneda, Strieber was already a best-selling fiction writer. So
he, but not along these lines.
Well, he was, but then he wrote several books after The Hunger that were not successful.
Which is another semi-suspicious sort of, at least in my mind, the way my mind works. It's like, okay, he tried one, it didn't work. Tried one, it didn't work. I got to come up with something new. You know, hits upon the idea after reading Missing Time, which came out in 81. Communion comes out in 88, 87.
Well, staying on that point about the hoax and the hoax, the hoaxer and the hoaxee, rather, and how it serves a psychological purpose for both, like it's providing some sort of psychological function for both. Like shamans, you know, they have these ceremonial ways of healing a patient, and sometimes it involves you know, pulling out an organ that's diseased, say, or sucking out some poison, and they will actually physically suck, and then they'll spit some ghastly black stuff out, or they'll push their hand into the person's flesh and come out with an organ. And apparently, from what I was reading in this Trickster in the Paranormal book, shamans are known to fake that, to use sleight of hand. They'll have something already in their mouth, and then they will spew it out after going through the motions of this, you know, enactment, a healing enactment. But it's effective. It's the placebo effect taken to this theatrical level. So at that point, like, well, is that ethical? It's effective. Their motives, let's say that their motive isn't just to become a powerful shaman, but to heal the person. Of course, it's likely to be both. Maybe this is the issue with Strieber or Castaneda, that they do something, that they do some medicine that is semi-fiction, that is, as you say, that it has the heart of truth, but there's adornments and enactments around it, narratives that are fabricated. They see that it's effective. They see that people are not just eating it up, but actually being nourished by it, that it really is serving some purpose and social function that makes them feel good about what they're doing. And so then they feel more and more justified in continuing with that methodology.
Right. I mean, what if you found yourself in a society that no longer valued the symbolic or the... I'm trying to think of how else to describe it. The metaphorical or these sorts of truths.
To have literal.
The only way you could communicate your message that you would be heard is if you put as a subtitle a true story. Otherwise, you'd just be completely ignored.
Well, you wouldn't be ignored necessarily, because, but you would be received in a different way, and it would perhaps be less effective. You would think that you were just taking drugs or eating candy rather than actually taking real medicine.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't be transformed by it in the same way if you require this literal ingestion of something real.
Well, you have to believe that it's real, whether it's real or not, is the thing. You know, you mentioned the, the sleight of hand tricks being believed and actually having a positive healing effect in one sense or another. I mean, the whole idea of a placebo, where you read about some sort of medical study and they give someone a placebo and they're cured by that whole placebo effect. I mean, that to me is one of the, like hypnosis, that's one of the most amazing things I've ever heard, and they just brush right over it. It's like, oh yeah, sometimes you can give somebody a sugar pill and it cures them of all their illnesses, you know? It's like, that actually can, but only if it's like, I'm a scientist and this is a study and this is medicine and this is going to be a medicine. Now you have to take this medicine. Once every 4 hours, this medicine is called, give them a big, long medicine-sounding name, You build that whole thing, it's, again, play-acting. That whole, everyone's in a fantasy world at all times, constantly.
Your point, Phil, is that that's just seen as an anomaly, and it's not important.
Yeah, right? To me, it's like, no, that's the answure. That's the cure of cancer right there. We just need better placebos, you know?
Yeah, better theatrics.
Exactly. Yeah, better sleight of hand. And it does work. I mean, a lot of those shamanic tricks are just that. They are tricks. It is sleight of hand. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't have the power to have an effect of one kind or another. Now, that that in itself is amazing right there, I think. I forgot my point, so I'll just stop right there.
Well, what about the flip side then would be voodoo, say, where all that kind of negative sympathetic magic where if a person actually sees and knows that some voodoo witch doctor is putting a curse on them, that it will it will be effective.
Right. You can do the same thing to yourself too, you know? Work yourself up into a friend, you know, you don't need some outside person, you know, performing a voodoo ritual on you to see it and know that they did that and to actually believe in voodoo to that actually have an effect. You know, you can be your own shaman, really, your own voodoo priest, your own, you know.
Well, we do it every day, don't we?
Exactly. And that's kind of what we're getting at, I think. To me, that's at least one of the most important things about all of this, to me, is how powerful that is and how prevalent that is and how all-pervasive that is. Well, you know, seemingly misunderstood, I think. I don't really read or hear much about it.
One thing I noticed about Strieber, and if you guys have listened to enough of his audios, but it's probably there in the books too, is how he will periodically stress that, well, you pointed out that on the cover itself, this is real, folks. This is really happening.
Yeah.
And right, he will do that at periodical intervals. And it is, even though it's very abrasive, so on one hand it's for myself, say, who's kind of sensitive to that sort of brash, bombastic, fanatical energy, it's off-putting. But even so, there is something sort of persuasive about it because he's so convinced. He can work up this energy. And it's the same when Strieber's challenged, like his dialogue with Pinchbeck. He becomes indignant and he takes it personally. And he reacts in such a strong way that although it doesn't really strengthen his case at all, it does prevent people from criticizing and questioning. Because who the hell wants to deal with that, right? Mm-hmm. And so in a similar way that when he's actually saying, this is real, folks, one thing it does convince one of, me anyway, is that he really believes it. And so then that kind of thinks, well, it must be real at some level because listen to this guy. You know, he's not, but see, then, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I just think, I see what you're saying, but I think if you scratch just beneath the surface, it can also be this idea that he's protesting too much, that he himself is not completely sure that this is real. Otherwise, why would he put so much energy into projecting that?
No, I agree, but I think it's both is the thing. Is that I think that, and Streep is kind of he's embodying this this thing that, on the one hand, invalidates what he's saying. If somebody who's more sort of attuned to that, what you just described, how, you know, fanaticism is always a sign of doubt, self-doubt. But I think there's another listener who is actually respond to that fanatical vibe. Probably more people, exactly where I was going with this. And it seems to me that, and I was thinking this while we were talking more and more about Strieber and him using the entities and him creating these crucial fictions, that it may be that his whole persona is actually the messenger for this message that he consciously or unconsciously knew was going to be most effective and reach the most people. So the very kind of qualities that make him lack credibility for us makes him more credible for another demographic and a much larger one.
Yeah, which is who he's playing to. Yeah. It's not for the people who are outside, it's for the people who are inside who will accept it and buy the books and follow and listen, and that's who it's for, really, you know?
Yeah.
And that's how you get that whole... Go ahead.
the people who want contact with aliens, for one thing. I mean, that's really right. Central to it. Like he's not just selling books; he's selling, you know, traumatic stroke evolutionary contact with alien beings.
I've never really fully bought into the alien hypothesis, as you know, because it's something that may be part of it, but if it is, the aliens who are around here know more about and have a larger picture of the world as it really is than we do, because when you're with them, the world changes in certain very critical ways, and I'll tell you more about that later. I got more and more deeply involved with these people. By another year and a half, I had written Communion, and I had begun to have people out to the cabin that we owned then in upstate New York, and they were also having experiences. It wasn't just me. One of them described it as being like an acrobatic trooper, these little creatures.
Put your hand up in the air. This is from the Peter House. Okay, sister, you have a just about spirit within you. You have a spirit of greed. You have a spirit of destruction.
That bores me. I'm not really interested in the demon hypothesis and these other hypotheses, the alien hypotheses, the hypothesis, the evil alien versus the good aliens. It's not something I'm interested in thinking about. I'm interested in perceiving and accurately describing the phenomena without regard to what it is, because that I cannot tell you yet. Okay.
Jezebel, spirit of destruction, spirit of grief, I bind you with chains of iron. I bind you here and be bound in heaven. Loosen your hold and come out of her now. Start blowing out, sister. Out, Jezebel, come out now. Go ahead. Out in the name of Jesus. Come out, destruction. Come out, destruction. Come out, grief.
Adequately conceived and inappropriate human response to a very provocative unknown. And now suddenly there's this reasonably articulate man saying maybe aliens are here too, at least that's how they perceived what I was saying. And they thought, oh no, this is yet another of these silly fantasies, and this guy is probably trying out there making a buck. He's a horror novelist, for goodness sakes. And so I was being attacked from that standpoint. Adequately conceived and inappropriate human response to a very provocative unknown.
That's right. Break your power, gentlemen.
An inadequately conceived and inappropriate human response to a very provocative unknown.
Not in
et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I don't know if it was in chapter 5 or something else that I read online, just read a couple of things where he claimed that, I don't know, was it late 80s, early 90s, somewhere, he was he asleep in a hotel room and he got up in the middle of the night and there was a man there and he was some sort of master of some sort and told him some shit and then gave him like some white liquid to drink, kind of thing.
Yeah, this is
I mean, and if he comes out and says, that's 100% real, it actually happened. It's like, that to me, that's okay. Fuck you, Whitley. That's hypnopompic experience right there. You're coming out of a dream. You're half awake. It's real. It might be meaningful. I mean, archetypally meaningful. Jung had, a lot to say about the act of imagination. These things didn't actually happen, but they were vitally important, and powerful. Mm. And the very sense, the heart and meaning of all meaning really is, that it has this archetypal, these powers, these magical powers that are within things, that kind of thing. So that to me kind of gave me the impression it's like, okay, he's going off the sort of beaten track where he's no longer just, being probed by aliens in the middle of the night kind of thing and seeing saucers. But
well, that's true. It's becoming, this is a human dimension has been introduced into it. But as you were just pointing out, this desire to assert the reality of it, the subtitle of the key is A True Encounter. So that's total echo of the previous work.
And to any listeners out there, just a friendly warning, if a man shows up in your bedroom in the middle of the night and gives you some white liquid and tells you to drink it, do not. Even if he says it's magic.
Uh-huh. I hadn't thought about that innuendo until this moment. Thanks, Phil.
You're welcome. See, I'm just here to help. That's my role here. I'm here to help.
Freshly made.
Exactly. I just whipped it up. Give me a minute.
Oh, dear. Well, I'm thinking there's a sort of full circle connection here to, since you brought up the Master of the Key and the hypnopompic question, that when Strieber had that experience and he woke the next morning and he found these scrawled notes on the floor, he said he couldn't read the writing, but when he looked at them, these packages of memory came into his consciousness and he remembered the whole dialogue. So that's like post-hypnotic, trigger devices of some kind. So yeah, whatever happened anyway, he managed to remember it in this very strange way. And he called up his wife. The first thing he did after he got the notes together was he called up his wife and he said, there will come a day when I will insist that this was just a dream. Don't let me do that. And the book Master of the Key is dedicated to Anne Strieber, and this is, I think, partly why, because he said that wasn't exactly what happened, that time and time again he wanted to abandon the book by saying this was just a dream, it's just my imagination, and she reminded him every time of what he'd said to her.
Yeah. Well, that's, a lot of that to me is personally familiar because I've had enough quote-unquote visionary-type experiences, hypnopompic, hypnagogic, normally, like as I said before, hypnopompic for the most part. And I kind of got away from that. It was very meaningful for me at the time, but the more I got away from that and just kind of and then I found the word hypnopompic to apply to it and then could kind of understand it. I didn't dismiss it. I still see it all as meaningful, but I kind of lost that tactile, that emotional, that complete, the mysterious suspension of disbelief aspect where you actually are hearing a voice and feeling that you're hearing a voice and getting the power from hearing the voice. Today, if I heard a voice, I'm not sure if I would, listen quite in the same way. Maybe I would, as I did back then kind of thing. So him telling her, there will become a time when I will insist that this is a dream. Don't let me do that. It's like, help keep me. You're my helpmate. You help keep me in this state of believing these experiences because it helps me to continue along this path of believing, at least as if, these things are all real, so I can continue along this path and continue to do these things that are possibly personally meaningful to him, and maybe he's getting some, completely innocent, well, maybe not completely innocent, but, some sort of personal meaning from it and not just monetary wealth and power over believers and so on, you know, you would need something like that. And it's like, I didn't have anybody, right? It's just me and my usual suspicions about shit. And, you know, I just kind of got out of it kind of thing.
What makes this so fascinating to me is that that he would recount that tale of telling his wife. Because if that were true, then he would not. Then he would want to hide that. He would not want to share that story that he told his wife.
If it were true, if which bit were true?
Exactly.
Or maybe, it's confusing, maybe but... he's leaving little clues in here for the real elite, the real people who are the real chosen ones to actually see through all this and do what we're doing, and then we'll enter the upper echelons.
Yay!
I mean, he could be planning little things. You could say.
Yeah.
Like well, that, to make you think that.
Yeah, that I guess that's possible too.
But... Look into that and then have your own experiences. But anyways, I'm not fighting for him or, you know, defending him or anything like that. But yeah, I mean,
I'm not,
it goes back to
sure.
a lot of those things. Go ahead.
I'm still not sure what Keith's point was, though.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go. What's your point, Keith?
Well, I'm a little bit confused myself, but if it was a dream and he... It didn't actually happen and it was a dream, then he would have absolutely no interest in telling this story about how he told his wife.
But you mean if he knew it was a dream?
Right.
But I mean, nobody has a dream like that. I mean, that just doesn't add up. It's the same with Castaneda's things. You can't, if you're going to allow or suggest that these experiences somehow came to him through dream, then you're allowing that dream is not what we think it is. The dream is a way to access some other realm of experience. So then we're back in the liminal again. So yeah, my take on Master of the Key, well, I allow two possibilities. One is that he was a very real human being, but he was part of some, you know, group of human beings that had a specific agenda and he wanted to get a message out, and that came to Whitley in the middle of the night. And because he's so susceptible to suggestion, the being, the whoever he was, maybe he was a Scientologist, who knows, managed to convince Whitley that he was a super being. But in actual fact, he just had this information he needed to get out, and he knew Whitley was a gullible enough guy to do it. That's one interpretation that I'm kind of allowing. The other one, which seems probably I'm leaning more towards, was that he was some sort of, I don't know if I'm leaning more to that, but let's say that he was a real being, but not a physical one. He was some sort of consciousness that interacted with Streber in that liminal state, and that Streber then, through these notes, you know, he was being fed this information in this hypnopompic or hypnagogic state, that seemed to be coming from a being, because where else would, you know, messages come from? And then he wrote down all the information, and that's the mimetic development, whatever that word is, mnemotic. What is that word, Keith?
Mnemonic?
Is it mnemonic? Well,
yeah, that sounds right, I think.
Okay, we'll go with mnemonic. Mnemonic device to remember that stuff. Which is kind of significant for a writer, as a way to fix reality and sort of, you know, package it and turn it into something you can actually use. So, and then when he read the notes, like, the full experience came back to him in a sense, but he, in the waking state, he then had to interpret it, translate it into something real, some something he could understand, which was an encounter between him in the physical and another physical being. And so he spun a tale, he spun a fiction out of that encounter. So then, is that a dream or is it real? It's both, and it's neither.
Well, my question, I guess, would be in the second scenario, does this being or consciousness have a point of view or a perspective, does it have an individual perspective, I guess?
You mean like opinions and stuff?
Does it have an its own experience?
This is the thing that, wasn't it, Jeremy Vaney was talking about with that Bernardo guy?
Yeah.
I don't know, that's like, is that really part of what can be known or needs to be known?
Well,
like, right. Was it autonomous being outside of Whitley's own psyche, or was it his higher self, or his, I guess, I mean, this is what the piece is positing, that it was his demonic self, but not in the true sort of holistic sense, yeah. But like the protector part of the guardian. So it was, and he wove around that sort of psychic fragment that is connected to higher, deeper knowledge, the image of his perfect father that he didn't have.
Yeah. I would agree with that.
Yeah, and the master of the key, the guy who showed up in his room, you know, is that, you know, one of his old handlers from the CIA come, you know, give him a little bit of a refresher there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You could, you know, there's a lot of ways to take it, but, you know.
And that's the thing about Strieber, that he doesn't really seem to allow, like, he keeps the world separate. The only way he allows the human sort of nefarious agendas to connect to this more transcendental encounters with the visitors is that one caused the other. It doesn't allow for them to actually be kind of, you know, embedded in each other, inextricably bound together.
I'm not certain on this, but I think I know that the Masonic, it seems like there's a Masonic ritual of lying in a coffin as well.
Yeah.
It just made me wonder if his father was possibly, I mean, whether he was a Mason or Skull and Bones, or, well, probably not Skull and Bones because he'd have to go to Yale, but that's just not a typical thing to have, a picture of yourself lying in a coffin. It seems like it would have to be the result of some sort of secret society or ritual.
Yeah. I have somewhere in my collection of family photos, I have a picture of my dad passed out drunk in the early to mid 60s, and somebody had written R.I.P. Tom Snyder on the picture, you know, because he was just passed out dead drunk kind of thing, you know. And so, you know, I got a picture of my father, quote unquote, dead. You know, wouldn't be connected to any of that kind of stuff, but yeah.
Well,
that was the first thing that popped in my head when I read about that.
Oh, yeah. And I think in this chapter 5, I mentioned how my earliest memory of my father is being dead drunk on the floor of the bedroom.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I hadn't made that, but yeah. Yeah, exactly. How about you, Keith? You got anything?
No, I don't.
Join the group.
No, I don't have any memories of my father like that.
Well, he's not one of us.
Yeah. Yeah, not one of the elite. Yeah. The upper echelon here. Have some white liquid if you'd like to drink it, you'll be okay. I have to mail it to you.
So that was we sort of digressed there from the basic question that Phil had, was like, you know, was in what way was Strieber's father not perfect? And I think that is a pertinent question, and it does tie into all of this stuff, that the picture that Strieber paints, at least for paranoids like us, with our own, you know, his secret histories to wrestle with, is of something very nefarious, but I don't think we need to, you know, interesting and titillating as all those possibilities are. You don't need your father to be part of the Vril Society or a Freemason to suggest that he wasn't there in the way that a young boy actually needed, and just how impactful that is, and you know. Like my story is not, okay, I don't actually remember most of my past, but then Strieber didn't until he was in his 40s, I think. Most of it was lost to him until certain points, certain triggers brought memories back. Now, whether they were the real memories or not remains unknown. But yeah, my point was is that my own experiences is that, I mean, I know from what I know about my father is that he wasn't, I wasn't able to identify with him. I didn't want to, and I didn't ever identify with my father, at least not in a positive way, let's say. I didn't ever see him as an example, as somebody to emulate. I didn't ever get that very early validation and kind of defining influence, whereby, okay, this is what a man is and this is how I individuate. And I've been fucked up ever since, you know, to be, not to be too glib about it, but I'm still kind of dealing with that lack of backbone, if you will, or lack of cojones, to be even more coarse about it, into my 40s. And that has, in that dealing with it has involved creating all sorts of crucial fictions, the most notorious of which was being the one, me identifying with Neo and this totally fantastic movie character, as a way to somehow come into my own authentic self, paradoxically or tragically or ironically or whatever you want to say about that. So that's, yeah, I mean, that's the focus of this chapter, and I think this whole piece to some extent is, to what extent has Strieber, like, created this fictional identity of manhood, this fictional representation of being a man, of being a leader, of being a teacher, all these masculine, you know, qualities to what he's doing, in the absence of actually having that, of having that inner sense of what it is to be a man.
Yeah.
It sort of that sort of reminds me of a quote that's later on in the piece by him out of Transformation, where he says, "I call them visitors, but now I'm beginning to think of that as a misnomer. I've had the impression that they think of themselves as family." Yeah. It just made me think that, I mean, what causes more sort of trauma and fucked upness than your family?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's not what he meant. He meant sort of the opposite.
Exactly. But, yeah. But it's symmetrical. There's a symmetry there. He's discovering in his own mind that these seemingly alien beings are his real family, but the flip side of that is that his real family are the visitors, are this alien presence that traumatized him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that this thing about aliens, back to when Phil was talking with Phil about your alien drawing and whatnot, is the alien is what you cannot identify with. It's the other. Mm-hmm. So if your father, the person that you're most like, viscerally that this person is most like you, if the your experience of them is so alienating, so unpleasant, so traumatic that you want to distance yourself from them, you need to even as much as possible, then you would feel alienated from yourself even.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Definitely. And then you could take this feeling of alienation and literalize it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And turn it into a way to be potent and powerful and upright and authority, the authority of being the alien ambassador in mm-hmm. this case.
Yeah, yeah, that's a significant loss of power there, yeah. So he would have to keep it up.
What would he have to keep up exactly?
Keep up everything that he does and say all of his statements, all of his beliefs, all everything that he does. Really, he has to keep. He can't in the end say, yeah. I kind of made it up. It's all, you know, just, you know, it's fun, isn't it? You know, it was play acting sort of. But, you know, I had a few dreams and couple other experiences, and for a while there I kind of thought I was, you know, being visited by aliens, and I realized, oh yeah, it was a dream. But then I started thinking, and I started writing, and, you know, I'm a creative person, and, you know, Don't get mad at me. You know, well, he's got believers now.
Well, is the question, I mean, I wonder if the question isn't so much whether it's real or not, but whether he really believes it or not.
Yeah, the question is, what is his, how does he exist within this entire thing that he's created? Well, you know, I'll put quotes around created, because, you know, that could mean a lot of different things. That was created around him, that was created for him, and he was forced into, that he created subliminally and didn't, you know, however it was created, but yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How does he exist within that? Mm-hmm. That is the question. You know, because I can accept a lot of these things, at least, you know, having enough dream experiences, hypnopompic experiences, synchronicities and things along certain lines, that some of which intersect, and one or two pieces of which, for instance, that feral child that he talked about, you know, having a very similar hypnopompic sort of dream experience, very similar to that thematically myself years before I had actually, this is my first time I read that was in your chapter 5 there.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, yeah, I can see these things having, yeah, it's could be powerful and meaningful. Yeah. But how do the believers exist in? Are they believing literally 100% concretely? You know, how do they play? Are they really completely believing it? And how are they believing it?
Yeah.
Same with him. Him mainly. It's like, that's the big question. The believers, of course, they, you know, I don't know what his believers are like, or what his followers, or whoever he's, you know, would be his insiders there, how they would exist within it. But I'm sure it's a lot closer to actual, you know, concrete 100% belief in it sort of thing. But
one of the things that I entertained when I was working on that John DeRuyter thing, which I never really completed to my satisfaction, of course that was all around my father issues, was that maybe this guy DeRuyter was enacting a certain aspect of his psyche, enacting and embodying his own shadow in order to bring it from into the light, you know, to bring it from the unconscious into consciousness, that was the only way he could do it. And I think that this is essentially what happens one way or another anyway, whether you're Hitler or whether you're Strieber or whether you're Jason Horsley or Phil Snyder or whoever you are. We're doing that consciously or unconsciously, with any number of gradations between. We're having to eventually recognize, identify, embody and own and integrate our worst aspect of ourselves, or our worst vision, or our worst fear about ourselves, which of course always comes back to the Father.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We're not going to become that, but the more that we try and escape becoming that or deny that we are that, the more it possesses us unconsciously. So what if, you know, maybe Strieber is somewhat conscious of that. Maybe he is enacting a kind of caricature of something that is very obviously inauthentic to us and seems untrustworthy and deluded and psychotic and all the rest of it. And the impression it creates, as I got with John DeRuyter, is that he's totally unaware of it. For God's sake, wake up and look at yourself. But maybe he's not. Maybe they're not.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I've never really been able to maintain enough commitment to my own experiences, really, to go on that path. But I can definitely see how somebody could go that way if they were committed to it, whether that required complete self-denial and unconsciousness of it, or actual conscious awareness of it, but making an active choice to say, well, but I'm still going to go forth down this path, even though I know it's not 100% real, this is a meaningful thing to do, you know? So you could go either way with it. Even if you go the total negative route, I can still squeeze a few useful bits of meaning out of communion, or from what I can tell, the little bits that I've read here and there of what he's written. Maybe I should look at more. I mean, I can, you know, even if it's completely debunked later, I know there's something in here. This guy is not completely unaware and doesn't, he's not completely, and he knows a little bit of something, whether, you know, wherever he got those experiences, probably, you know, we already know he's been involved in things, you know, in the 60s and onward. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's picked up a few things, and he's, you can, might, there might be a few useful bits of information you can get from him, but, you know, how do you relate to this guy personally, you know?
Yeah, well, I think that's, I mean, that for me, that's always been what's been in it for me, is has been less information and more something else. I mean, yeah. it's a visceral kind of identification. Like, I've always identified with Streep. I wouldn't be doing this. That hadn't been the case. And I still, you know, I reread Communion recently, and to say the first two thirds before he starts, you know, trying to interpret that experience, I find as compelling as ever. It's kind of irrefutably real, like this person is describing something that really, really happened to them, whatever it is. And that, I find that compelling, just that the whole sort of setup of that, of this, okay, ordinary in quotes, but this, you know, human being with a family and basically trying to be ordinary, having their life invaded by these forces of the unconscious, or of wherever, I would say it's always the unconscious one way or another, and wrestling with that. That to me is just maybe the most compelling story there is. Maybe it's the only story, like all of Shakespeare was probably that, if you choose to look at it in that way. Mm-hmm. Was one individual wrestling with his or her own unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And acting out these patterns and becoming part of this huge melodrama with these tragic repercussions and consequences, but that potentially does lead to some sort of whatever the outcome is, some sort of self-knowledge, I suppose.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, and that's my bent. I try to turn Peckinpah into a Shakespearean character, so it's probably just about me wanting to be Shakespeare. Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's a valid way to look at it too. I mean, you know, I might sound sometimes like I dismiss things, but I don't completely. So, you know, I can get meaning out of it, whether it's the meaning he and Streber intended or not. It's fine. Even if it's the opposite meaning, I can still find meaning in certain things. So in that comment about yourself, I think that's very important. You couldn't completely ignore that. And I've only got up to chapter 5, but I assume you bring some of that personal aspect into it more and more later on, don't you?
I think so. I mean, it's definitely continuous, whether it's sufficient or not, because it's difficult to strike the right balance, I find, between, you know, intimate and self-revealing and self-indulgent, which I think I've been in the past.
I had this habit for a long time. I used to get in my car and I would drive back through my old neighborhood, the old town that I grew up in. And, I would always drive past like the old houses that I used to live in. And I'd do it sometimes late at night when I used to be up at night. I got so I would do it really regularly for 2, 3, 4 times a week for years. And I eventually got to wondering, what the hell am I doing? And so I went to see the psychiatrist, and this is true. I sat down and I said, you know, doc, for years I've been getting in my car and I drive back to my town and I pass my houses late at night and, you know, what am I doing? And he said, I want you to tell me what you think you're doing. So I go, well, that's what I'm paying you for. So he says, well, what you're doing, he says, is something bad happened. And you're going back, you thinking that you can make it right again. Something went wrong, and you keep going back to see if you can fix it or somehow make it right. And I sat there and I said, that is what I'm doing. And he said, well, you can. Well, last night I dreamed that I was a child out where the pines grow wild and tall. I was trying to make it home through the forest before the darkness falls. I heard the wind rustling through the trees, and ghostly voices rose from the field. I ran with my heart pounding down that broken path with the devil at my heels. I broke through the trees and there in the my father's house stood shining hard and bright. The branches and brambles tore my clothes and scratched my arms. I ran till I fell, shaking in his arms.
She said, I'm sorry, son, no more.